All right, and welcome back to the On Par podcast. This is part two with a conversation with Ian Andrew, golf course architect. It's part two because he was recently on the radio show, and now we're sort of we were limited in a little bit of the scope that we were able to have a conversation. And now that we have him on the podcast, we can have a little bit of a broader, we can add a little depth to the previous conversation. Ian, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me back. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're busy with doing what you do. And although I did see you tweeting about how you thought that this was a more consistent year, which I thought was an interesting tweet, in the sense that whether my father was a general contractor, and I know what that tweet means in terms of, you know, architecture, just like construction and whatnot, can be a very feast or famine kind of industry. So it must be nice to have a consistent schedule as opposed to having these peaks and valleys.
Well, normally the way it works is, for me, winters are off. Mm-hmm. Spring is busy because the golf courses get going and they're trying to plan usually for the fall. And then summer can quieten a little bit. And then fall is chaos, always chaos. And so what was interesting about this year was the spring was steady, but it wasn't chaotic. And summer was busy with a lot of additional planning, more than I'm used to doing. And then my fall, I don't have as many large projects. I have a lot of little projects to do this fall, and one big one. And so it just means everything's sort of a little more spread out. It makes it easier to do better work, and also a little bit of things around with your, in my case, with my wife. It gives us a little bit more time. If it's chaotic, it's really hard to have any sort of life outside of golf.
Yeah, and there's something to be said about when you live in a world where you're creating, and it must be a challenge when you're under a time frame. It's a very interesting point that you bring up, because what you do is, I think, artistic, and it's creative. And when you don't have time to let things marinate, you often wonder what could be when you have time to let things develop organically, as opposed to sort of having a compressed time frame to work with. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes, it is, because a lot of what we do is intuitive, but mm-hmm. When I say intuitive, it doesn't mean that you depend on the very first idea. So when you see something, whether out in the field or within a planning process, you have instant reactions on what you think you should do or how you think should handle things. But a lot of times when you have some moments to sort of let some of those ideas marinate a little bit, sometimes you end up with a little bit better idea, or just a better way of doing things. Or occasionally, if you've given enough opportunity and you sort of plumb the depths of things you've seen, sometimes you find a completely new idea. And occasionally, that's a better answer.
Right.
So the more time you've got, the more you can sort of mull different ideas. It's like whenever I do planning, I always have it arranged so that I walk a golf course three or four times in the initial stage of the planning.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I do that is, first, I like to walk, and it paces you out and makes you more observant.
Mm-hmm.
But the other end of it is, I find it's like revealing layers.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you walk around, you see something different. Every time you walk around, you have new thoughts. And essentially, I find that walking three or four times rather than just one or two provides me with more opportunities to reconsider things or look for something different.
I imagine
time is valuable.
Sure. And I would think that walking also is your way of becoming more intimately connected with the golf course.
Agreed. I think what it is you, the land starts to speak to you. The more you're on it, the more the land starts to speak to you, and the more it starts to, for me, I find it really useful for grassing ideas, different mm-hmm. ways to change the mowing patterns that will bring out more of the land into more of the architecture. But also, you have a tendency to notice a little bit more If you're dealing with tree lines, inside of the tree lines, you're a little more observant. You start to see specimens sort of hidden within the forest that you can work to and clear to. And it just opens you up to different thoughts. I think we see a lot of the strategies and bunkering and the stuff that most people concentrate on, a lot of that comes pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the detail work, the deep detail work that really makes a big difference on what you end up doing with a golf course, seems to come with a little bit of extra effort and time.
You mentioned a word, and I didn't necessarily meant for this conversation to be a sort of architectural 101 type of thing, but I was just curious. You mentioned the word layers, and that's something that sort of gets thrown around a bit, and I'm not sure people really understand that when you talk about the depth of a golf course in layers. Would you be able to, can you expand on that just a little bit, that maybe the average person doesn't really understand about that?
Well, when we look at golf courses, everybody can sort of understand when I say that, you know, we look at green contours, we look at pin positions, we look at fairways, you look at the drainage that goes with the fairway, you look at the undulations in the land and how that impacts the way the ball runs. Tees, you can figure that out for tee surface and tee area and angles and things like that. But, you know, we start to look at other things. We start to look at settings. So you're looking at, can I open up a view? Can I frame a view? Can I do something with the tree lines that make the trees have much more, the individual trees have much more impact?
Mm-hmm.
Can I change the way you feel? Are you going to feel nervous and sort of worried about what you're looking at? Are you going to feel comfortable? We have the ways of impacting that with how we handle, again, that can sometimes be grassing or tree lines or tree corridors.
Mm-hmm.
But you start to consider sort of, and then one thing I'm very into is ebbs and flows in the golf course. I like hard holes to be hard, and I like more friendly holes to be, to be gettable.
Mm-hmm.
I like the mixture. I like to have the changes of pace. So I believe the game's a game that we enjoy emotionally. We don't talk about that too much, and everybody wants to break it down into science for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a really emotional experience. And I think it's really important when you're going around a golf course to understand that, you know, five or six grinding holes in a row, that may work for U.S. Open, but frankly, for a member, for just an average person, that's a horrible way to experience a golf course. So you're looking for sort of ebbs and flows. You should feel, there should be moments where you should feel that you've got to persevere through a couple of holes, but there also should be met with moments where you think you've got opportunity to score. And if you don't feel like you've got opportunities to score, then it's not very much fun golf. And frankly, when for the majority of golf courses, it should all be about fun. But fun is not just, here I'm giving you all opportunities and making it easy. That's kind of my knock at one of the courses at Sand Valley, is I'm not sure if you make things too gettable, if you're sort of getting away from sort of the spirit of the game, which is overcoming the golf course, but overcoming yourself. And that's why I believe you should have a little bit of perseverance in places where you're uncomfortable and places where you're pushed to sort of your limits, because one of the greatest feelings in the world is to overcome something that's overwhelming. That's the greatest high within the game, is to overcome.
Sure.
And so I think you need a bit of that. I think you need to feel good, and you need to overcome some things to really enjoy the experience. That's, to me, is part of the layers.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think it's amazing to me, and I don't have any knock against anybody who doesn't, you know, as long as they're playing golf, I mean, all the power to them, as long as they're having fun in the way that they want to have fun. But to me, that's part of the emotional experience that I find when I'm playing, because I'm trying to recognize what the intent was, like, why was the architect trying to make me feel a certain way? And that's trying to figure that out and trying to become connected with not just the land, but then the person who sort of put this test in front of me, that so that when I am finished with a round, part of me looks back and says, I really like the way, you know, the like you said, the ebbs and the flows, or the test versus the breather. Like there was sort of like a little intermezzo there in between meals before I had to then grind down a little bit, as opposed, you know, and that to me is so much more interesting as opposed to, let's say, a Bethpage Black, which I think is fun, or an Oakmont, which might be, an interesting test of golf, but it's basically being in the ring with Tyson for, you know, for 12 rounds, or whoever the heavyweights are these days, but or Muhammad Ali. It's not something I definitely want to do on a daily basis.
Now, you've interesting golf course to mention. So for me, Bethpage wasn't like that.
Right.
So I played Bethpage a long time ago, mm-hmm. and it was hard, but it wasn't a grind.
Right.
It was just hard. Mm-hmm. And it was a place that was worth going to play a couple times a year because mm-hmm. it's an exceptional property with a tremendous routing, great architecture. And it was just a test, interestingly enough, a test that sort of increases as you go through the round. You definitely mm-hmm. have some opportunity early.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't like is what they just did to it, which was they took it from a test with some space and some room and the ability to hit the shots, and essentially they've turned it into an all or nothing. That unless you can hit perfection, it essentially grinds you to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've actually ruined what was a great golf course with really horrible grassing lines. It just isn't the golf course it used to be. It's lost all its scale. It's lost the risk and reward. It's now just a test of execution. And a test of execution is fine for a U.S. Open and fine for U.S. Open level players, but it's not even good for an elite player, just an elite city player who used to go out there and enjoy it. They've just, it's a case of where golf has gone too far, or a setup has gone too far, and it's just missed the boat on what great architecture is. It's really, truly a source of frustration for me, that golf course, because I do think it's exceptional, and I do not think it's presented in a way that I think it's exceptional anymore.
Yeah, you're not alone. I a friend of the program, a Tillinghast historian, Phil Young, I'm not sure how much you're familiar with him.
I know Phil.
Yeah, and he's been on the show a bunch of times, and I can't even mention it. He gets so fired up. He has been so upset about what has transpired because he grew up playing that course. He's played it a million times growing up on Long Island, and he, like you, remembers what it was, and even me to a certain extent. I didn't know it like I know golf course architecture now was. I knew it from when I was just starting, so I couldn't appreciate it on the level maybe I can appreciate it now, but I know that I remember how much different it was, and I know what it's like now. And Phil has always been, he's like heartbroken over it. It's really been, it's been unfortunate for him.
I'm sort of the same. I'm annoyed.
Yeah.
I think it's servicing such a small group of players, and yet it's such a great piece of architecture. It should be enjoyed by a lot more than that. The way I first played it, you could go around it as a 18 handicap. You could go around it and play it. You may not play to your handicap.
Mm-hmm.
You just might, but at least you could go around it and play it and experience it. And there is no way you can do that now the way it's presented.
No.
You might as well just get in a cart or walk and forget about playing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so over the top. That's a good expression for it. It's just an over-the-top setup. And I'm not. It's like it's trying to prove a point rather than trying to be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a shame. It's such a, for the amount, for the dramatic property that it sits on, but I guess this is a whole other, this might be a whole other show as to, you know, when we talk about the business of golf and what, the choices that are made by, you know, by the tour or by certain organizations when they start, when they make certain choices for the reasons that they make them. Kind of hard.
I don't understand. Well, the tour stuff and all that's fine. I
yeah.
do think I'm not going to question them because my agendas and their agendas are actually completely different.
Yeah.
And it's like, I believe in all types of architecture. Mm-hmm. I believe in all types of approaches. I think it's good for the game to have just about everything. But there are, I struggle more when you've got something that's has a rich history and is such an important, iconic piece of architecture, to have it sort of not presented exactly the way it should be presented.
Right.
And so, and again, I know that's my opinion, maybe Phil's opinion. I would expect that's not Reese's opinion, but that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, it's a shame. I can imagine how you feel. I mean, I know how I feel, but someone like yourself who knows it, to the extent that you do, it's amazing. It's a shame they could have, what they could have done back in 02 or 2000 or when they started to, you know, plan for the first Open. It's just the opportunity that they missed to sort of really restore the golf course to its to really its greatness. It had really suffered after World War II. I mean, obviously, like a lot of golf courses, having the mowing patterns first it was ignored, and then when they decided to open it back up, they sort of just cut circles that were the greens, and so everything sort of lost its place. And here they had an opportunity where they had the full resources to restore it to its old glory. And it's sort of, that's a frustrating part, to know that they had the chance to do it and the resources to do it and then not do it. That's,
they chose an approach. Mm-hmm. You know, we've just gone through the, Open at Pebble Beach.
Yep.
The score was much lower than the old goal. And I don't think Pebble Beach was any worse, the U.S. Open and the feelings towards Pebble Beach were any worse for wear just because the number was higher.
Yeah,
that's the part I don't get. Just, you know, I find that the Open doesn't necessarily always identify the best players. It does sometimes and it doesn't others.
Mm-hmm.
But usually it's the over-the-top setup that does not identify the best player. It just identifies who can survive it. And to me, Beth Page is, the way it's currently set up, it becomes... It just becomes a bit more survivalist than it does allowing players to show their skills, take their chances, and go and get the Open. And you know, and that's why I'd rather see things opened up. But then there's a whole other aspect of the fact it's a public golf course.
Yeah.
It's one that anybody can go and play. Treat it like a public golf course. Allow people to play it. Don't try to – it seems like they're just trying to cut away the riffraff to just – tailor to the elite.
Right.
And again, I don't think it even presents the architecture properly.
Yeah, I think part of the feeling there is, well, you've got four other golf courses that you can go play, so if you want, you know, fun and whatever, you go play those. I it's the only explanation I can think of based on their choice. But, you know, I want to, you know, we're talking about something that is disheartening, but, you know, I'm just kind of curious what excites you about the industry, golf course architecture in its present form? You know, what parts of it that you look at and you see and it gets the juices flowing?
Well, first of all, we're in a historical sweet spot. Mm-hmm. I would say there's better work going on in this generation than there has been in all the previous generations till you get back to the golden age.
Really,
the work is of higher quality. The architecture stylings are work really well for every level of play. I think the elite player is still getting. Let's just take Stream Song for example.
Mm-hmm.
An elite player can go out there, but they're still going to be fully tested. But the fun part is, I can take any one of my friends out there, and they're going to have a great time.
Mm-hmm.
So. I think your leading architects are all building golf courses that are leaning on fun as much as they are on detail and challenge and everything else. And I think that reintroduction of the idea that golf is a pastime that we go to enjoy and it's not a penance we go to pay, to pay.
Right. Right.
You know, it's been good for the game that the game's become a little bit more inclusive and a little bit more enjoyable, and in an offhand way, it's relaxed a little bit. It's allowed players to find their own way around these golf courses, have a lot more room, make some choices, make some decisions, play away from things, try to carry things. And rather than sort of a test where you have to execute what the architect was telling you to do and forcing you to do,
mm-hmm.
You're given choice. And choice is where we find engagement, and that's where the game's most fun, is when we have choices and decisions to make and risks to take and sometimes a penalty to pay for overplaying our hand. So I think the game is in its greatest place that it's been in probably, well, that's nearly 100 years, at least 80 years. And so I think we are in a wonderful sweet spot. My only thing that's disappointing is there's not a lot of work to go around. So while we've got some exceptional people building a lot of work, nobody else is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we are going through right now is, unfortunately, we had a boom in a period, in a modern period, which wasn't as accessible or enjoyable, a period of architecture. It seemed to be more about challenge and championship.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an unbelievable amount of golf courses built through that period. And now we've got a period where we're building better work, but you're only seeing sort of 20 courses built a year. So it's going to take a while for sort of this new generation of architects to find enough, whether it's repurposing some of these modern golf courses or new stuff coming online, to actually see this movement sort of start to become bigger and broader and more interesting as it expands the ideas and gets sort of some hybrids between some different ideas and some different time periods. At the moment, minimalist is definitely driving the bus, but I'm looking for the next set of fusion between different styles, like the Mike Strand's work that we saw back in the 80s, where it's pushing things out in a whole different direction from a movement. And that's what I'm kind of looking forward to, but I don't think that's going to come for another 10 or maybe even 20 years. By the way, I think golf architecture is going to be all about rebuilding existing golf courses for about 20 years.
Right.
I think you're going to see so few new golf courses on green sites, on raw ground. In fact, I wouldn't be shocked if we start to see that start to slow a little bit. But the repurposing, the rebuilding, like a brand new golf course out of an existing golf course, I think that's about to take off. So it'll go slowly, but it'll just sort of pick up steam over the next 20 years. And that, I think, is going to be the future of architecture.
Well, there's a couple of things you said there I want to unpack. But the first one being, like, talking about this next generation of architects, you said it's sort of a select group of individuals who are doing most of the work now. It's sort of that old adage of a kid comes out of school and says, trying to get a job, and they say, well, you need experience. Well, how do I get experience if I can't get a job? But, you know, you do have people like the guys at Sweetens Cove, which is an interesting case study in some risk-taking and doing some interesting things for a little nine-hole golf course.
Well, they're a fascinating study on where I think things are going to go.
Mm-hmm.
With the core group is getting a lot of attention, a lot of coverage, and a lot of jobs. So they're good.
Yeah.
So you've got people who work on the periphery with them, or people are sort of pushing to try and do some of that new work, who are not one of that sort of that group of four. You get out to a dozen if you start to think more internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having to sort of force everybody to pay attention to them. So Sweetens Cove is a really interesting example where, you know, they rebuilt that nine and they've spent a lot of time promoting that project, getting the people they need to the golf course, but also just by using social media, really driving the interest in coming to see what they've done, and then sharing the experiences, particularly the positive experiences, and keeping keeping themselves in the forefront as well. And I think that's what's going to happen, is I think you're going to find that a lot of architects are spending an awful lot of time finding ways to become part of the conversation by seeking out the people they need to seek out, or using social media, or using certain projects to really push their presence more into the forefront and try to break in.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, there's not much there. And then Sweden's Cove is a really great example of, sometimes you might have to actually step in yourselves and create the project and be part of that project itself. So, that's one way to go about things that was done in the past as well. It's just a very difficult, with golf courses being so expensive to build, it's very difficult to actually have a stake in what you're building. But I think that's the only way some people are going to be able to break through, is they're going to have to actually take a financial stake in these projects.
Yeah, they've certainly created, and to their credit, obviously, they have substance, because you can do all the marketing you want, and you can be as engaged as you can in social media, and you can create a groundswell, but they've obviously have something special there, because they've been able to sustain it. It's actually something that I've been wanting to, I was thinking about maybe taking a trek out there this summer, just to experience it. And I don't think you can't do that if you don't have the substance behind what you're selling.
Well, they've created something that's very visually dramatic. Mm-hmm. They've pushed the edges a little bit, and so I think people are interested and excited to see what's got everybody else interested and excited. Isn't that how we sort of? That's how you get to, whether it's a movement or, that's how you sort of generate enough excitement to get yourself an opportunity.
Sure.
You know, somebody maybe paying attention to what they're doing and thinks, you know what, I'm going to ask these guys to come by and at least talk to them. And that's there's that moment that you're looking for, that
sure,
that foot in the door to pitch what you believe. And I think that's the biggest problem nowadays, is it's really hard to find those very few projects to actually get your foot in the door to be given a chance to pitch along with everybody else.
Do you like, I mean, I know you haven't been there, but is that the way they pushed things, the way they challenged some of the norms of recent? What do you find interesting about what they've done there?
Well, I've not been there, so
right,
it's really hard to judge the work, and I try not to when I haven't been
right
to a particular place.
Sure.
But I do know they've taken some gambles, and mm-hmm, I've always found it amusing when people, you've got somebody 1 minute saying something is probably a little over the edge, and you've got somebody else saying it's the most exciting thing they've ever seen.
Right.
That tells me that, put it this way, that's a good wheelhouse to be in.
Because right,
generally, particularly from an architect's point of view, that means you're pushing yourself. That means you're pushing the art. That means you're taking your creativity as far as you can. And then it just comes down to either set up personal taste or whether you've actually crossed the line. Because anybody who's really pushed themselves has had to go back and fix something.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never had to go back and fix anything and it's never come up at any point, then you're probably playing it way too safe.
Yeah, sure. I mean, failure and is sort of evidence of growth in a lot of ways. And
yeah, the tough part in this business, though, is failure can be expensive.
Yeah,
so,
right.
A total green site may be worth $100,000 if you're going to have to go back and actually,
right,
if it's not just a green surface, but you're actually having to take on a green site for some particular reason. And that's a number that not very many people are comfortable with.
Sure.
So I do believe that I do believe some things need to be out on the edge to be doing something really interesting and hopefully something brilliant.
Right.
But that is the risk you take, mm-hmm, of being really close to that line. But then again, the funny part is I used to have a list of my 18 favorite greens. I don't even know if I've got it anywhere anymore, because I don't think it's online. And part of it were these greens were all really on the edge of, in my opinion, they're successfully on the edge. But I do know there are a number of them got rebuilt in the end. mm-hmm. Which was super frustrating on a personal level. But it just shows you that some of the greatest greens do really, really, push what's acceptable, and that's why they're great, and that's why those holes work.
Right. You mentioned that there were a number of people who are, you mentioned the guys at Sweeten sort of taking some risks in certain areas, like you said, and seem to have pulled it off. And you mentioned that there's a bunch of, handful of people doing a lot of work who are doing things that, who are sound architecturally, challenging the elite player, but also allowing the high handicapper to get around. But it seems like they're a far cry from, let's say, a Strand, in terms of the risk-taking category, someone who really, really pushed the boundaries you talk about being in the wheelhouse of having people say he's over the top or it's awesome. It seems like this historical sweet spot doesn't seem like it has a lot of risk taking in it.
Oh, it does.
It does. Okay.
You break it out individually. I think Gil Hans, for example, is really taking a lot of risk with his greens.
Mm-hmm.
I think Corin Crenshaw have a couple of hole types that they like to use that push a little bit, and their use of extremely long fours really pushes the player to their brink. And they mix it really well with other stuff, so it just works beautifully. I think Tom whether it's a reversible course, but he seems to be always seeking out something that's really out of the box to push things to their limit. And I love the fact he's about to go par 68 for the new Sand Valley course.
Sure.
So I think the risk taking is out there within those guys. And I think there's other players as well. And I think they're also out there pushing the limits. Like I made the comment about David's course out at Sand Valley. I'm not sure. I've struggled with whether that's too accommodating of the player. But the other end of it is I got to give him full props for taking an idea to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I may question that on one end, but I've also got to give him full credit for at least seizing on something and then just going well beyond where anybody else has gone. And I think that's risk-taking as well.
Sure.
It may not be getting the reaction out of me, but it seems to be getting the reaction out of the majority of players that go out there really like it. So they like how it makes them feel, and they like the chance to get around there and be hitting an awful lot of shots out of fairways and knowing they can use a lot of feeder slopes and collector slopes at green sites and stuff to make their day go really well, that all they've got to do is identify those architectural elements, and it actually makes the game a little easier to play. I mean, that's taking a huge risk.
Mm-hmm.
So it all depends on us as players to whether we like the risks that the architects are taking or whether we don't. A good example is I really like Gil's work at Stream Song Black, but it's probably the most criticism he's taken about the extremes of green. So I'm finding with the players, it's either their favorite or they struggle with the greens. But again, that also makes it memorable because we're all talking about it. If we weren't talking about it, then what was the point of building it?
Right.
So whether you find it on the edge or whether you find it absolutely nirvana, that's good that it's actually doing both. The funny part is we all think that a negative reaction is bad, but it's not. A negative reaction, as long as it's balanced off with positive reactions, means that everything's being pushed. And I think that's when stuff's at its best. If you get both, that's good. If you get unanimous, there's a course in the Pinehurst area done by a very popular architect, where I'll never forget playing it. I turned to the guys I was playing with and I said, I'm about to shoot one of the lowest rounds I've ever had, and I've never been less interested in the golf course in my life.
Wow.
That's because certain things stimulate certain players certain ways. I don't like to be grinded to death, but I also don't like to be given things.
Right.
I like a bit of both in the round.
Sure.
And I find all the courses that I really enjoy, even the Wingfoots of the world. I find the Wingfoot courses, they're tough, but I never feel like I'm being grinded. I just know that I've got to play awfully well. But I also find that I can still hit recovery shots, and I never feel like I'm pinned down. There are golf courses out there where I just feel I'm absolutely pinned down. You know, it's height of rough, native areas, force carries, water, that sort of stuff.
Right. Bethpage Black.
Well, I always like to use the example of Pinehurst. It's an architect's favorite, more so than the player's favorite. And the reason being is I can take anybody there, and I defy you to lose a golf ball. It really takes a lot of work to lose a ball. You've got out of a really bad break. But I can take any player there, and I will put $10 on the line that you can't shoot your handicap or better, and I'll get paid 9 out of 10 times with a top-end player. The funny part is, with a higher handicap, it's actually an easier opportunity if you play conservative to get around under your handicap, because you don't have to hit those greens in regulation. You can play short.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love it because it's probably the most flexible golf design that I know of. It'll eat your lunch if you're really good because you have to take it on.
Right.
But it'll also concede a lot if you don't have to take anything on and you're just trying to tack your way around carefully avoiding trouble. You can actually still keep your score together as long as you just play good positional golf. You can actually get through it really easily. I've watched it done, and I've sort of done it the one time myself. I've also had my head handed to me when I was a better player.
Right.
And the funny part was, when I wasn't a better player, I actually had a much more effective game there because of what I didn't try to do.
Right. Yeah, you didn't think your way into trouble.
I love Pinehurst number 2. It's one of the greatest designs in the game. It's not the prettiest golf course, although I think what Coren Crenshaw have done has made it a lot more visually appealing, but it's freaking brilliant architecturally.
What do you mentioned the par 68. What do you think of that?
Well, I have a whole bunch of par 69s I work with. So I work with Agawam Hunt. I work with Plymouth Country Club.
Okay.
Both Ross courses. Plymouth actually holds a major amateur event and stands up really well because it's got 5 par 4s that are over 450 yards. And one of them is actually longer than the short 5, the only short 5 in the golf course. It just happens to be downhill into a punch ball.
Right.
To me, I've played enough UK golf as well, 68 or 69. I think we're stuck. I think we're absolutely stupidly stuck on par. I'm working with St. George's in Toronto that's going to have the Canadian Open next year.
Right.
And they're back and forth on which one of the 5 should play as a 4. But the funny part is they're not worried about par, but they prefer not to sort of give up 20 under because it's always in the cards because the players are so great.
Right.
But if they played both those 5s as 4s and played it as 69, it would be perfect. It would actually work perfectly too without changing anything. But we just can't seem to get over that hurdle to say 69 is fine. The day we do, it'll be funny. It'll be lots of them for tour events. And we'll stop trying to lengthen things and we won't gut golf courses the way we seem to gut golf courses for majors.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, right? This idea of a number and how much of an impact it's had on the game of golf. It's crazy.
Well, I always kind of point out that so the road hole is one of the most famous par fours in all of golf. It was a 5.
It was at one point?
Yep.
I didn't know that.
No, and so when I point that out, everybody just usually stops when you're talking about changing a hole. And, you know, one of the most iconic holes in all of golf has actually changed par. So it's not, you know, there are lots of golf courses. I can't remember what Prestwick was, but I know the Prestwick was a much higher par. I even know some of the courses around our area have dropped 1 or dropped 2. I've spent a lot of time counseling clubs into dropping their pars just so they don't, you know, rather than spend $500,000 rebuilding a couple of holes trying to make it work, just accepting the fact that a 5 and a 4 is actually a 4 and a 4.
Right.
And moving on with life. And, you know, looking at maybe $50,000 worth of work rather than just trying to retrofit the living daylights out of a hole to make it try to be something that it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I jokingly say, if I'm counseling you that to something that's going to cost me a lot of income, it's got to be a good idea, right? And I get a good response from that sometimes. Not always, but sometimes.
You mentioned that we're in this historical sweet spot, and I can't help but think if Seth Rayner showed up at your doorstep and said, you know, I hear this is you called this a historical sweet spot, you know, back, you know, to similar to the days when I was building golf courses. What would you say to him? What would the conversation? Where would you bring him? Where would you be? What would you want to show him? I'm just kind of curious, since you've made the comparison, what would you want to talk to Seth Rayner about?
Well, funny enough for me, I'm going to have to answer this personally to answer that.
Sure.
I would like to find out if he was the one who actually went and surveyed everything over in the UK. I've never been sure. I've read a lot, and I've never been absolutely sure of what he did or didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to know more about the national, what he did or didn't do, the choices he did or didn't make.
Because
the fascinating part for me is I think Seth Rayner's about as good a architect for laying out golf holes as there is.
Mm-hmm.
So he may have been working to templates, but he certainly found better holes than almost any architect in history. And I personally think he's highly underrated because everybody paints him with the brush of following templates that McDonald established and misses the fact that he was better at finding golf holes than just about anybody in the game. And I still think that's the most important skill of all. And so where would I take him? I would take him to some newer golf courses to find out if anything was worthy of a template, just to find out his opinion. I would just be kind of curious. I'd be kind of curious to find out what he thinks about, for example, the 17th at TPC, to whether he thinks that's good golf, bad golf, or I gotta remember he didn't play. So I'd be curious to see if he saw a template within that or saw it as just an idea that needs to be dismissed.
Yeah, it's just an interesting...
It's a great question. I wish I could answer better, and I'm really struggling with it.
Yeah,
it's
no,
a great
it's
a question you should ask another architect. It's a good one.
No, I mean, it's just, I just wonder, because you're in a... I know what maybe I would want to ask him or whatever, but I don't know the business like you know the business, and you're the one making this comparison to... what you think is I don't know if it's a second golden age, but you call the historical sweet spot. And I was just kind of curious what you thought he would think of it in terms of a historical sweet spot.
The interesting thing to keep in mind is he was super, super, super busy.
Right.
And I'm not sure he saw an awful lot of other work.
Right. Interesting.
So I know because I did a lot of researching for a book on Stanley Thompson. I know Thompson did visit a lot of other places. Part of it was because he's a real great player. Part of it was opportunity. And part of it is he always wanted to know what other people were doing. He had that competitive instinct to him. I'm not so sure Rayner was somebody who was spending that extra time going out to see other work.
Right.
You know, he may have seen some other work, but I don't think he was seeking it. Like, you even find that in our own golf business. You've got people in our business who are continuously, they'll be on the road, but whenever they're on the road, they're continuously dropping in on other places. And then there are others that don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's personality. It also has to do with what they do with their time away from their work. It also has to do with their marriage, or if the joke within the industry is their lack of marriage.
Right.
One of the things that's interesting is there's an awful lot of divorced golf architects, and part of it is just the time on the road.
Right. Sure.
I don't think it's anything beyond just time apart eventually kills marriages in a lot of cases.
Sure.
I know for myself, I used to always add the extra day and try to see as much as I can. I did hit a point where I felt I was obligated to spend a little bit more time at home with the family.
Sure.
So I still, I just do it in different ways now. I seem to put together a really amazing week that's strictly based around seeing things and doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I work, I work. I have a tendency to work and then come home. And that seems to work better for my wife. So I've sort of gone to that pattern instead. But before, I used to always try to combine and just add the day and add the day. And that worked well for me. And in the evenings, I still had the energy when I was young, because I started in my early 20s. I had the energy that I could do a full day. I could go walk a golf course at night and then get back to the hotel and, you know, eat a submarine sandwich or whatever it's going to be, go to bed, wake up first thing in the morning and start again. And I could do it for a week straight. I can't do that anymore. I don't have that in me.
No, I know the feeling. Welcome welcome to the club. It's
I can still go 36. I just it's funny, I can't work a full day, go walk a golf course, and then try to get up in the morning and be fresh for a greens committee.
I my one of the questions I wanted to ask you that I want to make sure I get in is, you, when you people go on your website and andrewgolf.com, they see a number of different things. Obviously, standard, you know, your traditional avenues in which you've made a living in this business. But one of the things that I think is interesting is the extensive blog writing that you did and still do. I'm just curious how much, you know, you write quite a bit, and I'm just wondering how much has that helped you in the past. And, you know, why did you want to do it, and how much of it is helped you shape who you are as an architect?
So a lot to unpack there, but it's all worth it. To start off with, a friend of mine actually talked to me. He always thought I was the best beer conversation that he knew on golf architecture. So he said, you should start putting this to paper. And I got to admit, at the time when I first started, that my reluctance was because I really couldn't write. And so I made a commitment to write, and I actually made a commitment so I could draw an audience to write every single day, and I did it for 365 days. What a crazy idea that turned out to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good for me. I would say about 90 days in or so, I actually started to show the initial early bits of good writing that started to show up. I was able to actually string together the odd paragraph that wasn't too bad after all. But when you do it for a full year, essentially it's like flexing your muscle, or it's like lifting weights. You may struggle for the first little while, but if you do that for a full year, you're gonna end up in a much better physical condition. Well, it works the same way with the mind. If you keep writing and realizing how terrible it is, but getting better and improving and learning more about language, you become a better writer. So that helped me, because it made me a good writer, which is really important in this business. But the other thing was, over time, I realized it wasn't just sort of sharing what I thought. I needed to actually research,
mm-hmm.
and I had to take it on as an idea of teaching people. And if I took it on as an approach that I was trying to teach somebody what I was trying to point out,
mm-hmm.
which meant I had to understand it better and I had to explain it better, it would be more interesting. So I went through that stage, and then what came with that was, I started to read a lot more, and I started to also reconsider. So after a while, I started to reconsider everything. And I would say, if you read the blog, you can actually read me reevaluating everything I believed and actually tossing things away that I was taught or believed and embracing new ideas. So I came out of the end of the blog a much better, much more articulate, much more thoughtful, and with a much deeper understanding of architecture
by
going through that process. And so the blog really only runs about 3 years or so. There's little bits of writing after that, but the bulk of it actually all comes out of a three-year span.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing of that is it was getting about 10,000 unique views a week. and which is a lot when you consider back then there wasn't the traffic that we see today.
Right.
And I started to be asked to either be quoted or participate in magazine articles. And I found that I would go somewhere and somebody would say, oh, I've read your blog, and that's why we've asked you here to come look at the golf course. Because every once in a while I'll go to a golf course and I'll go, all right, I'm a little out of the way. Why me? I just wanted to know what sort of drew, was it a recommendation from somebody or?
Mm-hmm.
But I was shocked a couple of times when people said, oh, no, there's a bunch of us have all read your blog. We think we wanted to meet you and think that this might be a really good fit. And
wow.
You're just floored at that point. It did open me up to a lot more exposure internationally, too. I was actually kind of shocked. And funny enough, I was shocked that my peers actually wanted to copy the content. So there were a number of them called me and were kind enough to say, I would like to copy the site because I'd like it as a book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to photocopy the whole thing and staple it together. But I really enjoy it and I like it for reference. Are you comfortable with me doing that? And it was like, yeah, it's on the internet. It's yours anyway if I put it on the internet. But I
right.
really appreciate the call. So it was good. It was really good for me. Again, a friend of mine talked me into it, and I would say it absolutely made a difference to my career. And if you would have told me that, Rob said it would, and I essentially said BS. I don't believe it's going to make a damn bit of difference, and I was wrong completely.
You know, it's a perfect example of what, regardless of your profession, you have to find a way to stay ahead of the curve. And one of the ways you have to do that is you have to push yourself professionally. You have to challenge yourself and, you know.
You got to put yourself out there.
Yeah.
You've got to figure out some way of drawing attention to yourself.
Yep.
Whether you're super outspoken like Tom. First of all, Tom's got tremendous talent anyway. But
right.
It was helpful for him to be so different than everybody else, to be so out. Tom Doak, for anybody listening.
Yes.
So helpful for him to be so outspoken and to be such a risk taker on what he said, what he did, the fact he was pushing a completely different idea from Pete Dye, who would be the most popular architect at the time. But he was out there. He also, the amount of legwork it takes to get to the stage that Gil's at, Bill Kaur's at, Tom Doak's at, David Kidd, Kyle Phillips. I apologize to any other architects I'm not thinking of right now. But to get to their stage when you've got to build it up from nothing, it's not like family or anything else or working through another firm. You're creating your business yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a tremendous amount of work. And I think that's the one thing that most people don't realize is that those guys that I've just mentioned have just absolutely killed themselves to get where they are. They've put in the amount of time making contact with the right people, going to all the things. My guilty point, and I have it pointed out from a couple of these guys, my guilty point is I won't go to where I should go to. And I won't participate in certain things that I should be at. And it's just, for me, it's I'm not willing to go as far as they are. But part of it has to do with I also like things away from what I do. And
sure.
And so I'm not willing to give everything up in my life, which would probably include a marriage. I don't want to give everything up in my life because I do have other interests.
Sure. Well, clearly you haven't been forced to make that decision, number one. And number two,
I've been lucky.
Yeah.
Somebody had asked me a while ago, are you bitter that you seem to have come along just a little bit too late to enjoy the explosion of golf courses in the modern age?
Mm-hmm.
And you're too young to probably hit the wheelhouse and there's no work for you. There's no new work. And I said, no, I was lucky. For Canadians, I'm the only one in my age group. I was young enough to get in where it mattered to build a business, to have the opportunities to do some interesting things. I can be upset about falling in between where probably it's my wheelhouse to do something new and to have tried to make a little bit of a mark doing a few new golf courses and making my own statement. But at the other end of it is there's a lot of people that aren't going to get anywhere. They're not even going to get an opportunity because there's just not a lot of opportunities to be a golf architect unless you're all in and you're willing to start out in the field and build for a decade or more before you even get any opportunities. So, you know what? Sometimes you got to take stock of everything and realize, in my case, I was lucky enough to be in early enough, even though that was late on that cycle, to allow myself to find a little bit of a small little narrow window that I fit into. And the other end of it is nobody did any restoration in Canada until I started doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got known as the restoration guy, and then restoration took off. Well, if you're the restoration guy, when it takes off, you're
the guy.
You're actually standing on a wave as it's moving. You won't get all the work, and nor should you get all the work, but boy, you seem to get asked for 80% of the opportunities. And you know what? That's all you can ask for. You miss more than you make, right? When you
sure.
go to interview with clubs. Yeah. If we didn't, then that would be crazy. But
right.
But at least to be asked, or I'm still lucky enough that I just get asked to do things without an interview process. Occasionally clubs just call.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know too many of my peers that get that. And I'm really lucky for that. So that makes life a lot easier too. Again, it comes down to sitting in a very, very thin, narrow space in the golf architecture industry. And I sit between sort of the large groups at the top and the large groups off to the side. And I managed to sort of run up the crack with nobody really there. So that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, but I think you have a very healthy perspective on things. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people who don't do what you just said, and that is sit back and take stock of what they have. Instead dwell on the things that they don't have, which can lead to a whole nother bag of problems. And I can appreciate that you're comfortable with what you've done and who you are as a person, and as a husband and a family man. And I think that's nice that's enough for you. And I think that's something that we should all aspire to be honest with you.
Well, I think there are some personalities that need to drive and strive, and they will do more because they are capable of driving for more.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got that personality type, I think you've got to see that through. I think you've got to also be really careful what you do to the people around you. You just got to be really cognizant of setting ground rules for yourself when it comes to other people.
Sure.
A good example is Gil Hans is a great example of somebody with drive, with a great family, and that he's figured out that essentially that you book family like you book work. And so that once you've made a booking, you don't shy from that. You know, you don't change. If he's got some really high profile, say Wingfoot called and he books with them, and then Southern Hills calls and says, can I actually have that date? No, he's going to go to Wingfoot, and then he's going to book Southern Hills for another date.
Mm-hmm.
What makes somebody like Gil manage to do everything right? Gil sort of, I idolize a lot of those, actually a bunch of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
They're all really great guys.
Right.
But what makes, just because I really know Gil well, what makes it work for Gil is he books his family first, and then he books his work around that, and then just asks people to work around that schedule a little bit. And I think that's why he's got an awesome wife and really great kids, three really interesting and unique and different kids, and a really good connection with them. But I think he's managed to sort of do it all by eliminating all spare time for both things, but also making his family as important as his work, but just having understanding to do it all. He's got to schedule it all.
Sure. Well,
sorry, that was a long answer.
No, that's okay. No, that's why we're here.
I'm one of those where I've decided that I will rather run out of work occasionally and have a little bit more time, and just Cindy and I will go and jump and do things, or I'll go and do things on a whim. I've decided I'm happy with running a little short on work, and I'm not worried about having to adjust my cash flow or what I'm doing because of it. I will let the ebbs and flows actually dictate everything in my life, and I'm kind of comfortable with that. So that's my lucky gift is I don't fret not having work like other people do, but I also don't have anybody working for me, and most people do.
Sure.
I think that's the game changer on that end.
Right. Well, Ian, thank you so much for your time. I can't thank you enough. I mean, this has been a very a fun and interesting conversation. It's exactly why I wanted to do the part two podcast, where we could go into a little more depth. Given the framework of my regular radio show doesn't really allow for too much of it, but this was right what I wanted to do, and thank you for everything.
Well, thank you for having me on. I hope I was interesting, but I appreciate the opportunity. I just find it a fun subject to talk about anyway, so I really appreciate the opportunity to chat.
All right, that was Ian Andrew from Ian, the golf course architect, and it was, again, a fun and interesting conversation. Glad to have him on, and thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.